Mars Science Laboratory. I hear a comment in there, Dick.
Yeah, that was Ed. A little bit noisy, but go ahead, Ed. WBCEAV. Any Northrop Grumman unmanned missions? You got it, Ed. KQRIW.
Now, the reason I called him was a comment. Unmanned probe. That's not completely true. Why? The guy who discovered Pluto in 1930, and about 20 years ago, and he was cremated, apparently half of his ashes are going along for the ride back to Venice.
Yeah, I'm hearing Ed both on the input and the output simultaneously, and there was some dropouts to the machine. Ed is indicating that the man who discovered Pluto, half of his ashes are on that spacecraft that is on the way to Pluto right now. Pluto, by the way, 39 Earth radius, in other words, the distance between Earth and Sun, multiplied by 39, that's how far Pluto is away, roughly 3.6 billion miles. So when the spacecraft gets to Pluto, and you want to talk to that spacecraft, tell it to turn around and take a better picture and whatever, the command you give it goes up on a radio beam at the speed of light. To go 3.6 billion miles, the signal takes 5.4 hours one way. And think about the way NASA gives commands to these spacecraft. You give it a whole bunch of commands and say, don't do it. These are the commands I'm giving you. Tell me what you heard. And then the spacecraft speaks back and says, I think you said such and such. So, see, you give it the command, not counting the amount of time it takes to actually transmit the command, just the amount of time for the signal to get the leading edge of it there one way is 5.4 hours. And then at the end of the message you say, tell me what you heard, another 5.4 hours, 11 hours round trip. You start studying the message and say, okay, it got it correctly. And another 5.4 hours, let me drop it. One way, you give it another message saying, yes, you got it right, now go do it. Kind of amazing to me that up till now, the fastest thing any of us can imagine is the speed of light. And can you imagine an 11-hour round-trip communication? You say hello, and you get a hello back 11 hours later. That's something else. And that's just to Pluto. What used to be called a star, I mean a planet. Now it's a planetismal or a planetary thing. And the distance to a star is way beyond that. Just something else. Big distances. Okay, stand by a second.
K2YO.
Bernie, you want to say something to us?
Sorry about the interruption, Dick. We're just trying to test out a problem here. As far as the interruption, please keep going. Please keep your while.
Very fine, Bernie. Let you know that your audio is a little bit interrupted, a little bit thicket-fenced, and the audio is very reasonably low in volume and very low in tonal quality. Nothing there beyond 1 kilohertz. And so when you guys are up there making changes to the pre-emphasis circuit and the amount of gain in that audio, you might want to know that. Mel, I'd like to know what are the major kinds of emails you've been receiving this week, or kind of questions. We've actually got to that at 10:45. We're doing a little better, Mel, with the email questions. K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
This is K2KEY. First of all, I just looked up the ICPW1. I want to refresh my memory. The amplifier utilizes an advanced 16-bit MPU to run the various high-speed protection circuits, as I think I said. It will sense overdrive, high SWR, antenna DC overvoltages, etc., which means that any of these failures will shut the amplifier down immediately, Dick. A 16-bit band microprocessor that runs supposedly these high-speed tests on the amplifier. So give you an idea if anything is wrong in that animal, that it will go into the self-detect position and say, you know, so you don't get a, you know, smoke coming out of the amplifier, Dick, over.
Sounds like a rather nice piece of equipment. And as you would say, I'll bet you that's a little bit pricey. Is that around $3,000 for that afterburner?
A bit more. A lot more than that. With the 7800 at the time, got a deal, I think it was $14,000 for the two pieces. I think that's what was the price, to give you an idea. I believe around $14,000 to $15,000, somewhere in that neighborhood. A little pricey for ham equipment. But, listen, you only live once and you got a few bucks, why not enjoy it? This is basically what may happen. They do caution here. Number of the amplifiers failure have been due to poor ventilation. You do have heat sinks in there. You do have a fan system. But some people, they put them into, shelves, bookshelves and things like that where there's just not enough air movement. And some of the failures, especially if they're going to use them in Packard, RIDI, or any of those modes, have found that these amplifiers have failed in a couple of years from overheating, Dick. So ventilation seems to be the key word in this, with this amplifier, over.
Glenn and you, coming.
Go right ahead, Alex.
Thanks, Ian. I think that this is the problem. You cannot use a microprocessor into the SWR detection circuitry. Between the detector of the SWR and the execution of the command, because this is a processor running at limited speed, there will be probably 100 microseconds. This is long time enough to burn all the transistors you want to in a bad case of SWR. The SWR circuit must be analog with a response time of less than 30 nanoseconds, which is a cycle, one cycle at 30 megahertz, that will protect the amplifier. I believe that hot air and whatnot is just, that's what it is, hot air. They're covering up this stuff. Back to you, Dick.
Interesting. Wesley, go right ahead.
Alex said it for me.
Alrighty, so you're a little bit skeptical as to whether or not that amplifier can be properly controlled with a micro. I do know that one of the pieces of equipment I own, let me drop
KC2QIQ with a comment.
Glenn recognized. One of the pieces of equipment I own is a KU band traveling wave tube, a couple of hundred watt amplifier controlled by a microprocessor. And the RF energy picked up by that microprocessor gave all kinds of troubled responses. KC2QIQ, K2LIW in the TechNet. Joe recognized. We'll get to you after Glenn. Go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, actually, some of these circuits I've had a chance to look at and review a few of them. There's the ones for the ASU, like the BL7000, and they have the new one, the Quadra. And I took a look at had a chance to look at some of these schematics in the ICOM. And what's interesting about them is that the micro is kind of like a final report, and it will basically give you the readout and give some of the longer-term information. But interestingly enough, a lot of the circuits that are actually doing the real turndown are still analog. So it's kind of a hybrid between, some analog circuitry inside there with the detectors. So they kind of do still detect with the VSWR with a detector, and there is an amplifier in there with a fairly good slew rate on it. And it's not too as terrible as it really sounds. It's not as if the micro is directly reading an A to D and then going through the full cycle time of the microprocessor to give the turndown. It's actually, there's some analog circuitry that actually gives those turndown commands pretty quickly. so the recycle time really isn't as long as you'd think. And then basically the full report time, maybe to the LED and some of the other functions, are actually all delayed, but the actual fault indication is actually much quicker. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Okay, then that's okay. How the thing was read, I understood that a microprocessor actually controlling the shutdown, the biasing or whatever. And to an engine going back away.
Very fine. And when you go to K2MIT's website, you can see a picture of this rig that he's talking about. Quite an elaborate piece of hardware. Joseph, haven't heard from you for a while. The signal was a little bit weak, a little bit low in amplitude as far as audio is concerned. But go right ahead with your comment to B2RYY, T2RIW, the TechNet.
Oh, well, that was the portable radio for my house in Glen Oaks directly, so now I have an outside antenna. My comment is your East transmitter is not working right now. That's my comment.
Yeah, I think they're working on it, but hopefully they know. So the linking to 147.375.975 apparently is not there right now. Was it there earlier, Joe, and did it just drop out because somebody timed it out?
I don't know that, but I can't key address it with my HD either, and I've always been able to do that.
It was working early in the net, no problems, XWS2N.
I just tried keying it and got no response. So, from my point of view, 147.375.975 appears to not be on the air right now. Alrighty, back to you, Mel, with your email. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Very good.
Yeah, go ahead, Eric.
The reason why you can't hear 375 is I'm in the middle of changing the repeater.
Okay, so you got your fingers, your finger poking in there, and that's why it's off. Now we know where you are. Back to you, Eric, for any other comments.
No comments. Just upgrading and also letting it go in.
And don't forget about the pre-emphasis because your audio is quite muffled. But good, clean audio, but very, very muffled and a little bit low in amplitude. K2KEY with the mailbag. K2RIW. Go ahead, Mel.
This is K2KEY. Yeah, I didn't get a chance to look over things because, as I said, today was quite a day because of the holidays, both the Passover week and, you know, and a Palm Sunday, being that the family is split between two. We get to celebrate both, and everybody was toasting everybody, and, you know, you don't want to offend anyone by not toasting. But it gets out of hand after a while, so I'm not used to it, so I'm just reading over now some of the emails. Let's see. Okay, I'm just picking up ones that more or less people that, you know, young people are interested in and all. Some of the stuff is too much detail to get into directly, and again, it gets out of hand because, again, we got the same situation over and over again. These questions, for instance, correction, somebody's asking for a correction on a formula. He doesn't agree with the formula for dynamic range. And, you know, the formula is, it's just considerable math in it and all, and he's got a different formula he'd like to bring up, and would like to know if we could discuss this formula. But I think that would be a little bit out of range of what we're doing, Dick, to get into a very deep mathematical formula here. Am I correct? Over.
I believe that's true, Mel. When it comes to the concept of those charts and graphs that are given to you in an evaluation of a piece of hardware that's in QST magazine, where they tell you the blocking dynamic range and spectral purity of its oscillators and sensitivity and power output and intermodulation distortion. There's a bunch of parameters there that, in theory, an informed amateur should look at all those charts before he plunks down his money. You would think that was going to take place. It is my belief
that a more rational or a how would a reasonable and prudent man behave in this particular situation? Let me drop it. The vast majority of us are not exactly fat with money. In other words, we don't have a whole lot of money to throw around. If we did, we just buy rigs and sell them and don't worry about the details. But most of us, when we finally buy a rig, we intend to use it for a significant length of time, and we'd like to get a lot of value in what we buy. And in my opinion, one of the best ways of knowing what to buy is to ask informed people. If, for instance, 20 meters is your favorite band, and if you've got any kind of equipment that you can bake, borrow, steal, or go over to somebody's house and use periodically, and get on 20 meters and say, okay, of all the rigs that are out there, which one do you guys like the most? Which ones have given you trouble? And be willing to use older equipment. If you can buy surplus equipment that is one or two generations old, like you take, for instance, the rig you're listening to right now.
Connected. KC2WYP.
You're listening to a Kenwood TS711A 2-meter all-mode rig. That's what I use. My favorite 2-meter transmitter as a base station rig. It's got one of the world's best frequency synthesizers. It's got a power supply built in. Thoroughly from the front panel, I can go anywhere from 1 to 30 watts of output. So as a driver for tunable IF systems on 144 to 148 megacycles, tunable IF that gets me up to any of the other microwave bands, 1296, 10 gigahertz, 24 gigs, and whatever. Tunable IF on 2 meters is a very popular way to go. So this rig does everything I need. It probably is a vintage 1985 piece of equipment. Or maybe, yeah, I think it's around 1985. To the average person, it is a 25 years old. To buy something of equal quality today will cost you about $2,500. I can buy this particular rig many times over for $500, $400, numbers like that. You're getting a lot of money, a lot of rig for your money. So regardless of what the charts and graphs will show you in a evaluation report of a rig, check with your buddies, check with the people who are on the band, find out what they're using, what they like, what they dislike, and don't always have the attitude that you've got to have the latest and the greatest with all the horns and whistles, unless you want to spend a whole lot of money. You can get a lot more value at this particular piece of equipment. If I use it for 5 years like I have and sell it for 5 years from now, I'll probably get 95% of my money back. And so it's money in the bank, and it's a darn good performing rig and very reliable. It's got one hell of a track record. Guarantee if you're a 20-meter man, there's an equal piece of equipment on 20 meters. That's my approach. It's not the only one, but it's one that I think you should consider. K2K.
Repeater. Time out. Repeater. Time.
K2KEY. K2LIW. Don't do what I just did, Mel. Sorry about that.
N2EO, Dick.
Go ahead, Rich.
Okay, just a comment. I'm into the vintage stuff, and the vintage stuff has been going up in price. Where the Yaesu Kenwood ICOM stuff, brand new, you'll pay a lot of money for it, and it depreciates in 5 years. The Collins, the EF Johnson equipment has been appreciating over the last few years like crazy. So if you buy something like a Collins or a Johnson or something like that for HF, fix it up, you could probably in a few years, you get tired of it, sell it for what you paid for it or even more.
So one way or another, either a vintage piece of equipment or just something that has an extremely good track record on used equipment, you can get a lot for your money. The average guy buying a piece of used equipment is scared to death that it's going to have a failure. It's been thrown down a flight of stairs. It was previously owned by a person who was a smoker. There's all kinds of things you can worry about. My way of looking at buying a used piece of equipment, if you can turn it on and it lights up, so to speak, and if you have some faith in the person you're buying it from, 98% of what's required to make that particular piece of electronics is in that box. And the 5% that may be not working correctly, You've got a guy like Andy W2CDL who can fix anything. So you show up at one of the tune-up clinics of Limock, and you'll make that work. Or talk to your buddies on the technical net. You'll get that piece of equipment working. So I don't worry about buying a piece of used equipment that it might not be perfect, that something might not be working correctly on it. But that's me. Not everyone's got that attitude. Some of the people will lose an awful lot of sleep for fear that one of the functions won't work correctly on a used piece of equipment. Whereas a brand new piece of equipment, you can send it back under the warranty. There's pluses and minuses of each approach. I'll bet you Mel has used and bought quite a bit of used equipment in his day. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Yes, I have quite a bit. And I'll say for sure I still have quite a bit. One time, Richard mentioned Johnson. I had everything that Johnson ever made, actually, at one time. I collected them religiously and had every piece of equipment actually here at one time. what I let it go for today, God's sake, I made a ton of money on it. But that was a long time ago. The Collins equipment you mentioned, yes, Collins is way up there. I have a Collins KWS-1 and a 75A4, which are actually mint condition. The way it exactly looked the day it came out of the carton, it is spotless physically and perfect working order electronically. And the prices I'm offered for it is just beyond comprehension. I'd never believe it. Let me drop for a moment. Oh, if you're into that kind of stuff, well, what the heck. It's great to have and a lot of fun to use. That's the bottom line. All right, you were mentioning, let's get back to the mail here. You were mentioning, one of the questions I have gotten here, I see it's gotten a few times from new people. They're really, like you say, purchasing rigs. What the heck do they mean, these MDS? And how do I understand MDS? Meaning, of course, the minimum discernible signal, MDS, or signal response, minimum signal, minimum level required for a discernible signal response. That's basically the definition of MDS. How do I understand this? How would you explain it to a newcomer, Vic, or somebody out to buy a radio? Over.
I'm hearing W2 ALP on the input, but not coming through the machine. So you might not have your PL tone turned on. When it comes to MDS, minimum discernible signal, on a 80 to 10 meter rig, that parameter almost doesn't matter. Of course, that sounds crazy. You'd like a receiver to be so sensitive it can listen to a weaker and weaker and weaker signal. Well, on 80 through 10 meters, when the band is open, the total amount of noise on the band is, in most cases, 20 decibels louder than the number of microvolts of minimum discernible signal. It's hard to get a HF radio that is so dead, so insensitive, that it doesn't hear the noise coming in the antenna when the band is open. So, yes, that's a desirable sounding parameter, and maybe when you want to work, you want to work some ground wave during the time that the band is not open, then it may make a difference to you, but there's 90-some-odd% of the time, minimum discernible signal is not a real parameter that makes a difference. By the same token, if I looked at a Cadillac rig and it has at full power output 100 watts a third order intermodulation distortion rating of 30 dB, and that was the Cadillac rig, and if the Volkswagen rig, so to speak, had a reading of 27 dB, are you really going to hear the difference? Not in the world. So these are real parameters. They do to a small degree separate the men from the boys as to good rigs and not so good rigs, funny job. But many of these parameters are slightly important if you were doing state-of-the-art work. If I was using the receiver as a tunable IF, because I'm putting a microwave transverter in front of the rig, then some of these parameters would really have meaning. But once again, you're going to be way ahead of the game, in my opinion, to talk to people who have used particular pieces of equipment that have acquired a track record. They know them and love them, and you look at the resale values and how well it holds up and whether or not people are complaining about it. There are a couple of rigs out there that are dogs, that are real troublesome. There's one particular production run of an ICOM rig, which had a synthesizer, which had rivets going through the PC board in order to make contact between the upper layer and the lower layer. And those rivets developed oxidized contacts, and the rig became extremely intimate. There was one real dog like that. And there's one or two other dogs, let me drop. Where way back in the day when there was a volatile memory system where the lithium battery inside upheld the dynamic RAM memory that was in the microprocessor that was the computer program that ran the rig. And that when that lithium battery ran down in about 7 years, every single button on the front panel became inoperative. You had to send the rig back to be reprogrammed as well as changing that lithium battery. That particular class of rigs way back in 1975 are very troublesome, and maybe you want to avoid one of those. So there's a couple of dogs there, but other than that, there are very few dogs. But many of these parameters, I think, are not very important in the real world. Adjacent channel selectivity, if you're on a really busy band during a contest, yes, that's a pretty important parameter. How sharp are the filters and the skirt selectivity of the filters? That's a real parameter. But many of the other parameters that are not so easy to explain, to understand, I think are not very important. MDS and third order intermod are two of the parameters I can think of immediately, which you and I probably would not look at those parameters at all, or if we did, we would look at them last before selecting a particular rig. What do you think, Mel? K2KEY, K2RIW.
The ARRL, as you know of late, have been reviewing in detail equipment with their laboratory standards now that are excellent because they have, you know, been able to acquire the equipment from Rohde & Schwartz to be able to make very in-depth measurements. And one of the measurements that they are showing is the receiver sensitivity, and they take the measure data. I'll tell you how basically they call it, you know, yes, they do. They actually show it as one of the figures, the MDS figures for the receiver that they do make that measurement. And it's usually taken, for instance, at the 2.4 kilohertz bandwidth. It has been so-called noted that their standard is a readable single sideband signal requires a 10 dB signal-to-noise ratio above the noise floor, in other words, by 10 dB. So you're going to have an example today of a modern, you know, receiver will with a well-calibrated F meter, will show, like, say F9, 50 microvolts for F9. So a indication of, like, say, S1 would be somewhere around 0.15 microvolts for a 10 dB signal-to-noise ratio in the known as the 0.1 to 30 megahertz portion of the band.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Oh.
well-calibrated S-meter, S9 should be 50 microvolts. And if the S-meter is perfectly calibrated, which means 6 decibels of difference for each S unit, that means S8 will be 25 microvolts, and S7 will be 12.5, and so on. You carry that all the way down to S0, it should be 0.19 microvolts, a well-calibrated S-meter. No rig has an S-meter calibrated that well. A really good single sideband rig probably will get on laboratory instrumentation something like a 10 decibel signal-to-noise ratio of single sideband coming out of the loudspeaker when something like 0.1 or 0.15 microvolts is going into the rig. And so if the rig that you're thinking of buying is 0.1 and another rig is 0.15, and if you think that is a real reason for selecting A versus B, I doubt it. Because when you connect a properly working antenna to that receiver, you're not going to see 0.15 microvolts. You're going to see about 5 microvolts of noise from Mother Nature. The real noise of the band is so much louder that the real signal-to-noise ratio by which you hear that signal determines what the state of Mother Nature's ionosphere is today. So minimum discernible signal, in my opinion, except for a couple of rare circumstances, is not a major parameter I would look at. I wonder how you feel about that one, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet. Wesley recognized, but Mel first. Go ahead, Mel.
You're correct. In recent times now, in the last few years, I don't think that is a notable point to look at. But if you look back at some of the older radios that to produce a an S1 required 0.25 to 30 microvolts. So in today's modern equipment, it may not hit the standard you want, because along with this, you're also going to find the next measurement that is mentioned, and we'll get into that in 1 minute, called the two-tone dynamic range, which I agree with you, I think would be more of an important, as they say, that what is known as the DR, or dynamic range. But pick up Wesley first. Go ahead, Dick.
Dick said something about the noise. I have a question to him. What do you understand, Dick, by the term white noise?
Okay. On a good day, if I tuned across the 20-meter band during the time when no other ham is on the band, and I listened between 14.0 and 14.5 megacycles with good laboratory equipment on a correctly operating antenna, the amount of noise power I would see, I could display it on a spectrum analyzer, a pan adapter of a receiver, there's lots of ways I can display it. The noise will be reasonably flat. In other words, the total amount of noise power at 14.0 and 14.5 are going to be very, very similar. Flat noise versus frequency, most people call that white noise. And the word white noise has got a bunch of relativistic meanings. If I was strictly a 20-meter man, and I'm building some kind of a noise generator for laboratory testing, my definition of a white noise generator is one that's flat across the 20-meter band. If you take the words literally, a piece of laboratory equipment that does automatic noise figure testing will produce a constant amount of noise power across an extremely large frequency region, like 1 megacycle to 12.4 gigahertz inclusive, and noise power would be completely flat. That would be a white noise generator.
The white noise in respect to power spectral density.
Now, when I talk about noise power, and noise has to be measured in a way that's different. Wesley knows this, but I'm saying this for the benefit of everyone else. If I'm measuring the signal coming out of a signal generator, and I measure it at 3.5 megacycles, and then I turn on a different signal generator, and I measure it at 12.4 gigahertz, if I set each of those signal generators at 0 dBm, which is equal to 1 milliwatt, everyone knows what that means. A signal itself you usually measure as a pure power relationship. Noise, though, has got a peculiar characteristic. If my receiver has a very broad filter in its IF strip, it's listening to a wide band of noise. If my receiver has a very narrow filter, it's listening to very little noise. The very narrow filter, with the exact same gain through the filter, measured with a signal generator, the narrow filter will hear a hell of a lot less noise. So noise has got this peculiar characteristic that when you define noise power, you haven't defined it at all unless you simultaneously tell me how strong is the noise power and what was your bandwidth of measurement. If I'm using a 10 kilohertz wide filter and I measure 0 dBm, I could say the noise power density, because it's got the word frequency in there, is 0 dBm per 10 kilohertz. And then because 10 kilohertz versus 1 hertz has a 40 decibel ratio to it, that exact same amount of noise power would be called minus 40 dBm per hertz. Many people will, let me drop for a second. In order to have a level playing field, many people will define noise power as either dBm per hertz or dBm per megahertz, depending on which kind of testing you're doing. So with noise power has no definition of it all if you didn't simultaneously define the bandwidth or if everybody knows ahead of time that you're referring it to a 1 hertz or a 1 megahertz bandwidth. So bandwidth has got to be there when you're measuring noise. Now, a thoroughly white noise generator for automatic noise figure indication might have a flat noise power density anywhere from 1 megacycle to 12.4 gigahertz inclusive. That was a quality product manufactured by a number of companies. You can buy that kind of a white noise generator, meaning it's flat in noise power density at all the frequencies of definition. N2XJN, wait for the beep, A2RIW in the TechNet.
Well, I believe that white noise is not only one factor, it's a number of factors, and you have additive white Gaussian noise, and some things that are included in it is fighting frequency interference, non-linearity, and dispersion. That's what I believe. I don't believe that the white noise is just one single source that you described, but two.
And you're absolutely right. Now, Wesley is now getting into the next two or three parameters. If you're building, buying, or testing a so-called white noise generator because you want to do automatic noise figure testing of a receiver, a preamplifier, or so on, in theory, you're caring about the noise power density at various frequencies, how white it is. That's one kind of whiteness. Also, the distribution of noise voltage versus time. If I'm now using something that's equivalent to an extremely fast oscilloscope, and I'm looking at some particular section of the noise, maybe I care about what's going on at 100 megacycles coming out of my noise generator. So I use a very fast 100 megacycle oscilloscope, and I look at the noise power in the vicinity of 100 megacycles.
About black body radiation.
That noise power at 100 megacycles must obey, Wesley used the word Gaussian, he meant Gaussian is the way we usually pronounce it, Gaussian noise distribution. In other words, the voltage has some kind of a mean value magnitude in true RMS measurement, but the noise also for a couple of nanoseconds is going to be extremely weak, and for a couple of nanoseconds it's going to be extremely strong. If I plotted per probability density distribution. In other words, if the vertical axis is signal strength, the horizontal axis is probability. I got it backwards. Horizontal axis is usually signal strength, voltage strength, and the vertical axis is probability. When you plot that, it should be a bell-shaped curve, a Gaussian-shaped curve. That's also part of the quality of the noise. Another quality of the noise is crest factor. Let me drop. Mother Nature, when she makes purely white noise, and sometimes she does that, if, for instance, you have an undisturbed sun, which is close to being a black body radiator. In other words, a black body radiator is one where if you know its physical temperature, you know exactly what noise power it's putting out. A hotter object puts out more noise. And if you study that noise of a purely black body Gaussian distribution noise generator, it has this bell-shaped curve of amplitude versus probability. It's got a certain shape of noise power versus frequency, noise power density versus frequency. It also has a certain crest factor. Crest factor is what's the highest peak of noise power you can get during any one nanosecond, for instance, versus the average. Human speech, for instance, has a crest factor of 23 dB. In other words, if you made a careful measurement of the average male voice, and you look at the puff of air coming out of his mouth when he says the letter P for Papa, and you look at the average noise power that he's making when he's speaking, the peak of noise power, the peak of voice power, is 23 dB stronger than the average. That's the crest factor of human speech. And how well your speech-limiting circuit in your single sideband generator of your your rig, how well it properly reproduces that without creating too much distortion, so you can't easily understand what the man is saying. I mean, you'd be amazed how much complication there is in crest factor, mean value, Gaussian distribution, whiteness of noise, and so on. So lots and lots of fancy measurements can be made on white noise or speech or black body signal. The so-called, let me think now. Can't think of a man's name right now. There's a famous man who, it's called the Wien displacement, among other things. When you take something like the sun and you measure its noise power versus frequency, it follows a particular curve where the noise power gets louder and louder as you go to higher and higher frequencies up to a very specific point where it falls off precipitously, falls off very fast at higher frequencies, shorter wavelengths. You go to a hotter temperature black body object, and at all frequencies it puts out more noise power, but the peak has now moved to the right to a higher frequency. So black bodies have got this peculiar characteristic. However, you usually only see that at optical frequencies. Down at radio frequencies, noise power is a lot more behaved in noise power versus frequency, noise power density versus frequency. Is this close to what you're referring to, Wesley, M2XJN, K2RIW, and the TechNet?
All right, then by this statement, N2XJN, I don't believe that this is only such high frequencies appearing. And I have a question for you. What is the origin for the black body radiation back here?
I'm hearing W2ALT, Bob, sign in for a few times. Not one of those times have you come through the machine, Bob. So either your signal is not making it tonight on 8.5, or the PO is not turned on. And under normal circumstances, I'd recommend you go over to the 147.375 machine. But that machine is being worked on, and it's not part of the system tonight. So maybe we're not going to be able to hear you through the machine, that is to say. Now, the last question you asked, Wesley...
Origin of the black body radiation.
Okay, it's working again. So we just heard that the 147.375 machine is working. I recommend you give that a try, Bob, because
your 8.5 signal is not coming through the machine. Every object above absolute zero in temperature has kinetic energy to its molecules or atoms. One of the things that's never made clear to us when we study physics and when we study science in our high schools is, what does temperature mean? If I walk down Fifth Avenue, New York City, and ask the first 100 people I run into, what does temperature mean? I would get a series of answers of, it's something you measure with a thermometer. It's a degree of hot or cold. It's got something to do with chill factor. There's got a whole lot of words about temperature. But if you ask a real scientist, and you keep asking him why, five times in a row, what is temperature? But why is that? What you'll finally find out is that your thermometer is measuring the average kinetic energy of those molecules. That's in the case of a gas, it's how fast are the molecules moving. If those molecules are moving X number of miles an hour, they've got a certain temperature. If they're moving twice that amount of miles per hour, because kinetic energy is one-half CV squared or one-half MV squared, they would have four times as much energy. The absolute temperature in degrees Kelvin would be four times higher. So once you know the temperature of something, and there's lots of ways you can measure it, with a radio telescope, you can measure the temperature of something even though you're a zillion miles away from it because of its black body radiation. Let me drop.
So where's the black body radiation coming from?
Sorry. I'm getting there, slowly, step by step. A hotter object has more kinetic energy of its molecules. A hotter object, when the molecules themselves are moving faster, and the electrons that are going around every one of those nucleuses are along for the ride, is more electronic energy. A higher temperature object has more velocity of its molecules. The charges of those electron clouds going around that molecule are moving faster. They generate random voltage. So there's a direct relationship between your 50-ohm dummy load resistor and how much noise power it puts out versus its temperature. A 50-ohm resistor at your favorite frequency, and it doesn't matter what frequency, if you've got the right kind of instrumentation, and if it's at room temperature, 290 degrees Kelvin is the definition of room temperature by the IEEE standard, it will put out black body noise of minus 114 dBm per megacycle. Let me drop. If your laboratory instrumentation had a 1 megacycle noise equivalent bandwidth, and you look at that 50 ohm resistor at room temperature, 290 Kelvin, which is somewhere around 65 degrees Fahrenheit, it will be producing a noise power of minus 114 dBm per megacycle. You aim a blowtorch at that 50 ohm dummy load and heat it up to twice the temperature in degrees Kelvin. Instead of 290, you make it 580 degrees Kelvin. That's pretty hot. You heat it to that temperature, and you make the same measurement, the minus 114 dBm per megacycle will be minus 111, 3 decibels louder, twice the noise power, because you've doubled the absolute temperature in degrees Kelvin. The nice thing about black body noise is that there's a one-to-one relationship between absolute temperature and absolute noise power. And all black body objects follow that characteristic. You're about to ask, what is a black body object? Is that your next question, Alex? Go ahead.
Well, actually, you contradict me. It looks like it comes from the Earth.
Defining a black body is not easy, but it's sort of like pornography. I can't define it, but I know it when I see it. A truly black body substance is one which obeys the law of predictable noise power versus absolute physical temperature. Every black body
any material that is black at your particular wavelength of observation. If your material is truly black by the definition of black body radiation at your wavelength of observation, and if you know its physical temperature, you know exactly how much noise power density it is emitting into space or into your coax cable or whatever. But we're getting a little bit far off of Mel's original email, which is asking about the parameters that are in those product reports that are in QST magazine. And the bottom line of what I'm saying is that you can study each of these parameters. Some of them are kind of complicated, but I think you're going to discover that only a couple of them really address the way you use that rig. And when it comes to choosing a rig, going by testimonials of people who you respect could give you a hell of a lot more information that is useful than those particular parameters. Those parameters are good, but they're not easy to use directly, as I'm giving you a couple of examples of that. But that's a strongly felt opinion. Not everyone's going to agree with that. Let's see how Mel feels on this one. K2KEY, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Okay, I thought maybe somebody else wanted to join us. Well, let me put it to you this way. When they are reviewing equipment today in the ARRL lab, one of the tests that they show you is receiver dynamic testing, and they will show it to you for a number of different ways that they test it with preamps on, preamps off, different filters in and out. And so what they are showing you, actually, let me put this MDS to rest in a simpler form, that for instance, if they say to you that this receiver with a noise floor that of 100 minus 130, 130 dBm will produce a readable single sideband signal of a minus 120 dBm. So you look in that column and you get an idea what that MDS means. So when you're comparing it, they still use that as a comparison. You get an idea that most of the modern radios today will go down to a noise floor of a minus 130 dBm to produce this readable signal. And that's what you'll see in the first portion of the review. Let me let it drop. What you'll see in the first review of the receiver. Say a few words about the transmitters. Most of all the transmitters today in modern piece of equipment are all basically quite the same and have very similar characteristics. They all sound, let's put it this way, bottom line, very good on the air, meet all FCC standards. So you don't have to worry too much about that. If you're into weak signal reception like I am, I like to pick the signals out of the dirt. And so I have a number of very sophisticated filtering systems I've come up with. And you can buy things like that today. They'll be mentioned as roofing filters and things of that sort today that they are offering. The next thing that you will see is maybe more important, and that is DR, dynamic range, two-tone dynamic range testing. So can we pick up on that, Dick, or do you want to discuss something else? Over.
I have a question, Dick. Does the white noise...
Okay, when it comes to dynamic range, two-tone testing or total dynamic range of the receiver, that's getting into a more important parameter. Particularly if you live in a metropolitan area and you've got a lot of nearby ham radio operators, or you intend to use the transceiver during a contest, how far away can a super strong signal be and you still get desirable performance out of the receiver on your tuned frequency? How far can that be away? Skirt selectivity is part of the factor. Overall receiver dynamic range is another factor. In other words, you'd like a receiver to be able to receive super weak signals. In order to do that, you might add quite a bit of preamplification before the first stage of mixing. The first RF amplifier might have quite a bit of gain. That'll give you the ability to listen to a weak signal. But then when the signal gets stronger and stronger, all that extra gain up front is going to cause saturation somewhere downrange in that receiver. Every receiver has an amplitude of signal coming into it beyond which it does not behave correctly. And there's a lot of different ways it can behave incorrectly. Pure saturation for a signal that's on frequency. Partial saturation or desensitization for a signal that's in the adjacent channel, 10 kilohertz away, so to speak. So blocking dynamic range is an important parameter. Not too often do they do two-tone testing of a receiver. A two-tone test more frequently is used on a transmitter. Blocking dynamic range and skirt selectivity or adjacent channel selectivity, adjacent channel power ratio, these are the kinds of things of a receiver that in a contest environment could become very important. I wonder how much testing you've been involved in, Mel, or actually seen differences in brand A versus brand B of receivers because of instantaneous dynamic range, blocking dynamic range, adjacent channel desensitization, these kind of parameters. Now you're getting into something that's kind of important, and I wonder how much of that kind of testing or side-by-side comparison.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
You and the guys at the Kings County Radio Club, I'm wondering how much you've been involved in those kind of tests. I think those could be quite important. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, this is K2KEY. Yeah, they're still doing two-tone dynamic range testing of the receiver, Dick, and at the ARRL lab. And their standard is it's measured at a 20 kilohertz point on the band pass. And it actually is, as Dick says, it compares directly the strong signal handling performance of the receiver. And it does this before something else comes called the third order intermodulation distortion products rise above so-called noise floor. So what this means in simple terms, if I can really simplify it, the lower limit of the dynamic range would be the power level of the weakest detectable signal that's above the noise floor. And the upper limit of is the point in which intermodulation products are at a level of noise floor. And so we get into what is then called the IMD. The IMD is very important when you look at the factors of IMD. Let it drop.
Yeah, my first question, Mel, and you're on a beautiful subject here. How far separated are the two signals from each other? And how far are they separated from the center tuning of the receiver when that test is made? Thank you, Mel.
Also, WB2EAB with comments.
The tests are made with 20 kilohertz offset, known as the offset. And it's measured. The measurement is taken at, at the a ratio of 3 to 1. So, in other words, they call it the parent signal, and they use it with a 3 to 1 ratio, so that the IMD is actually producing 3 times faster than the desired signal. I mean, that's the standard, and that is the method that they're using for blocking gain compression, Dick, with a 500 hertz bandwidth. That's 20 kilohertz offset, 500 hertz bandwidth setting, Dick, over.